Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Cindy O'Meara. Cindy is a leading nutritionist, filmmaker, best-selling author, TEDx speaker, and founder of Changing Habits and the Nutrition Academy. She has been a trailblazer in the natural health space for several decades. Long before there was more widespread awareness of the danger of hyper-processed foods, Cindy has been an advocate of whole food nutrition as well as using ancestral lifestyle patterns as a guide for wellness in the post-industrial era. She has been involved in so many projects that have brought more awareness to the issues of chemically based agriculture, low carbohydrate diets, and much more. Cindy also co-hosts a podcast called Up for a Chat, with hundreds of episodes covering a large range of topics. Cindy has been at the forefront of the health space for longer than I have been alive, so it was a great pleasure and privilege that I had the chance to speak with her. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. So thank you, Cindy, for coming to speak with me. It's a bit odd having spoken to you very recently, having you onto my podcast now. So thanks so much for taking some time.
I'm really looking forward to this. I've looked at the caliber of speaker that you have on your podcast, and I've been listening to a lot of your interviews, and I feel very privileged to be on your podcast.
Wow, thank you so much. Yeah, you're certainly up there. You've been doing this for a really long time. I think somewhere around 44 years you've been you've been in the game for. So that really counts for something. Experience really matters. It teaches you things that you can't learn in the books. You just have to be doing it for a long time. So I'd love to know a little bit about how you got into this, because I think like a lot of people, it starts with a personal journey and you have a familial story that's very interesting and telling with regard to how you got into all of this.
Yeah, and there's lots of nuances in amongst all of it, but I'll give you just the general aspect of it. So my father was a pharmacist who became a chiropractor, and my mother was a nurse who became a mum. And I was brought up in a very different lifestyle, one where my father believed that medication was for only emergencies. So if we had a cold or a flu or a fever or anything like that, he chose not to give medication unless he felt it was an emergency. So I am 63, 64 this year, and I've never had a medication, no antibiotics, no Panadols, no nothing. So I don't have the story of I was sick and I got better. I had the story of I was given an incredible start in life. So watching my mum and dad and how they looked at health, I decided that I wanted to do something with health. So I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder to do pre-med, because I didn't know what healthcare I wanted to do, but I knew that if I did pre-med, I'd get an idea. And while I was at the university, I had the opportunity to do anthropology with an incredible lecturer. And I did not only anthropology, but cultural anthropology. And at the end of my time in Colorado, I thought, I know what I want to do. I want to become a dietitian. So I rang my mom in Australia and I just said, I'm going to become a dietitian. Is there any universities nearby that does it? So I just happened to end up at Waurn Ponds in Geelong, finished my Bachelor of Science majoring in nutrition, about to do dietetics, and realized that it wasn't going to have anything to do with anthropology and cultural anthropology. And I didn't agree with any of it. There was margarine and breakfast cereals and low fat and counting calories. And I'm just thinking, this has nothing to do with our history. It has nothing to do with vitalism, which was the philosophy I was brought up in. So with my philosophy of vitalism, which is the opposite to mechanism, where mechanism says, you have a problem with your heart, let's look at your heart, let's find out what's happening with your heart, let's treat your heart, and we'll move on. Where vitalism is, you have something wrong with your heart, as long as it's not a heart attack, remember, that let's have a look at your environment, let's have a look at your whole body, what's affecting that, is it a mineral imbalance, is there a salt imbalance, whatever it might be, that's what vitalism looks at. So I took that healthcare vitalism and put it into nutrition. And, you know, after finishing my Bachelor of Science majoring in nutrition, not going on to do dietetics, thought I didn't know enough about the human body. So went on to do 2 years of human anatomy, cutting up cadavers and really understanding the human body. And after 6 years of university and thinking, I actually do know what the body needs. It needs what we had through anthropological times. It needs real food. So I set up a practice as a nutritionist in Melbourne. at my sister's practice. She was a chiropractor in 84, 85, and started to just practice real food nutrition. And I have to tell you, Cameron, back then I could get people well on just taking them off margarine, breakfast cereals, you know, getting them on real food. I could get people well. And here we are 40 years on, and you can no longer do that. I don't know what has happened in that 40 years. Well, I actually do, but I just feel that we have depleted our ability to be well with just food. We need almost extremes in food in order to get well. And that's what I, you know, that's what I've learned in that time. So becoming a nutritionist was just, in hindsight, being in the right place at the right time, having the best lecturer, and leading me to something that makes sense. And I have done nothing but use Vitalism and anthropological principles as my guiding principles to nutrition. And it has never, ever steered me wrong. When everyone's saying margarine, I said butter. When everybody was saying no salt, I said, no, we've been having salt for a long time. When people were saying low fat, I was going, no, we've been eating fat. When people are now saying no meat, I'm going, no, we eat meat, you know. So all I do is go back to those two guiding principles in its holistic form and in its anthropological context. And we seem to come up with the right answer every single time.
It's interesting how the death of Vitalism has led us to sort of where we are now, treating biological systems like machines when they are decidedly not machines. They work not even very, very complexly within themselves, but also interacting with everything around them. So it's almost impossible to look at an organism without looking at everything else that's going on around it. And I think that's where Vitalism, you know, and I think Vitalism still lives on in certain Eastern traditions as well, which I think probably serves them in the way that they look at the body. And this is exemplified in, you know, the Eastern traditions. Ayurvedic medicine takes this on really well and employs the vitalistic way of looking at health and wellness. And I think arguably that's a much better system than the mechanistic one we've got now. Like you said, there is this desire to focus only on the thing where the illness is manifest, which is absolutely crazy, because very rarely is that where the actual problem is stemming from. It is just happens to be where it manifests. And I think the background that you have in anthropology is really, really important, and probably one of the big reasons you've sort of been able to put all of these ideas together in a broader context. It's funny, I recently spoke to Nina Jablonski, who's an anthropologist, and she looked at the biological and social importance of skin color. And the insights that she got from an anthropological point of view actually informed me so much about why sun exposure is important and how we've got it so wrong. And just in the same way, Jeff Leach, who's an anthropologist who headed up the Human Microbiome Project in Tanzania, his anthropological input into this question of what is the human microbiome, you know, what's an optimal human microbiome, how does it shift, how does it work? Oftentimes these other views other than a medicinal nutritional investigation into these problems yields so much more information. And I think that's why I really like looking at these anthropologists, because they actually look from a broader context. And I think that's where we have to look to get things right, is to zoom out, because so often we're so zoomed in. And I think that's why you've probably been successful over the last few decades, being able to actually help people, because you're sufficiently zoomed out, you're looking at the big picture.
Mm-hmm. And you have to realize that both modalities are really important. And in mechanism, if I'm in an emergency, I don't care what water I'm drinking or what sunshine I'm getting. I need that heart to start, or I need that blood to be stopped, or whatever it is in an emergency. we need mechanism. So we need, they're polarizing, but they're both required in humanity. They're not only required for us to understand what is happening out there, like reality and atoms and things like that. And I love that. But what's happened, I believe, is that mechanism has taken over everything. And we've forgotten that there is this other polarizing effect that we need to look at as well. So I think if we could take that mechanistic aspect away from all healthcare and look at both sides of it, we might do far better. But it's not going to happen, because at the moment our doctors are taught how to diagnose. They're specialists, you know, like I have a really good friend, her husband's a urologist. I have another good friend, he's a gastroenterologist. I have another friend, you know, the cardiac surgeon. I have all these friends who have got these husbands or wives that are specialists, but they're not looking at maybe diet, or they're not looking at sunshine, or they're not looking at, well, what is the lifestyle that these people live? Do they live a sedentary lifestyle? So I believe that both are necessary, but we need to be very considerate about which one we're overusing. And we see mechanism and vitalism in food as well. So what I was taught when I did dietetics was mechanism, and it's actually called in nutrition terms nutritionism. And it was coined by a Russian, believe it or not, living in Australia in about the year 2000. And it is mechanistic nutrition, which is where we look at the carbohydrates, the proteins, the fats, the salts, the vitamins, the minerals of a food to declare whether it's good or bad. Now, that could be a food that's completely manipulated. So it could be a protein bar that's got a protein powder in it. And it could be chocolate coated, and the chocolate coating is not just chocolate, but it's, you know, palm oil and flavors and emulsifiers and this and that. So when I was taught dietetics, it was like I was being taught this very mechanistic way of looking at food. And because I was brought up as a vitalist, it was very hard for me to look at food mechanistically, but I understood why they were doing it. And this is where the problem in food industry has become, is that we can make a food look perfect in protein, fats, carbohydrates for the ketogenic diet, the carnivore diet or whatever, like maybe not carnivore, but maybe the ketogenic diet or the vegan diet. We can make food look perfect on the mechanistic way of looking at it. But if we look at the vitalistic view, all we're seeing is a bunch of chemicals thrown together to make you think food looks like food, tastes like food, smells like food, but isn't food. And our body doesn't recognize it. And then we're wondering why our body can't figure out what it's eating or what it's meant to be using for its metabolism. And we wonder why we're getting sick. It just, to me, it's like a common sense thing that we have never lived on these foods that are so mechanistic. We've always lived on foods that are vitalistic. And the more I study and the more I realize, like I was listening to, I think it was one of your podcasts, and it was a guy on minerals and analysis. I'm pretty sure it was one of yours. I listen to so many podcasts and then I find the person and then I hunt them out. but I was listening to him and he was talking about minerals, and I've never been somebody who says you've got an iron deficiency, you should take iron, unless it's an emergency. That's different. And I've never been someone, if you've got calcium problem, is that the underlying problem? And here we have the science now that shows this, that just because your blood says you're low in something doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you should be taking. So I'm very much of the ilk of let's get it through our food as much as we can and make sure that our food is regeneratively grown or found at the farmer's market where we have farmers that are growing that food. And then the soil's right, the microbiome and the soil ecology is right, and it all just works so beautifully together instead of being so mechanistic in the way we think about food, you know, like this carbohydrate, protein, fat obsession we have. But food has it perfect. It just has it perfectly put together. And yet we're obsessed with, oh, I should be having this much fat and I should be having this much of this. And, you know, the RDI says how many vitamins and minerals we should be having. But when you consume food that has been grown correctly and you eat it correctly and prepare it properly, then I believe that your the body's knowledge and its innate intelligence and the food that you present to it just knows what to do for you to be the healthiest version of yourself.
Yeah, nature doesn't make any mistakes. And if we just sort of step back and get out of the way of our own doing, generally speaking, things will probably tend towards getting better. And that's a very difficult thing to understand, because you always want to add more things in. If you're not feeling well, you want to think, what can I add in? But a lot of the time it's, what do I need to take away? What am I doing that's actually contributing to the problem? And one of the things I really like about what you're doing is you're talking about these things that don't often get talked about, that are these things that do need to be removed. And that extends well beyond food. I mean, we had a discussion not so long ago centered predominantly around these other things that contextualize the intake of food and make the food make sense to our body. And this is centered around things like light exposure, circadian rhythms, even extended to the other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that our ancestors were never exposed to. So when did you start to think a bit more broadly than food? I mean, you spoke before about the things that you used to be able to solve just by changing basic things in the diet no longer work. So clearly some things, there are other environmental things that are going on that have made it that, you know, these things no longer are sufficient. When did you start to really ask questions beyond and what prompted that?
Yeah, well, this is when I did have a health issue. Okay, so I got to my 50s, and you know, this is when we go into perimenopause and menopause, and I was starting to put on weight. I had a very sore right hip, tightness in my throat, foggy brain. I wasn't, you know, I was still eating the same, I was still doing the same things, but I seemed to be having health issues. And somebody said to me, oh, it's menopause, Cindy. And I went, no, I never had problems with my cycle. Why would I have problems getting out of my cycle? So me, being a nutritionist, decided that food would be a good thing for me to look at. So I went on an elimination protocol, and it was based on a book in the 70s called Pounds and Inches by Dr. Simeon. And I had a 2-page thing on it, and I thought, yep, I'll give it a go. And it was basically lowering the amount of calories you were taking, and it was eliminating everything but meat and above ground vegetables, basically, and some winter fruits. So the first 3 days on this protocol, I wanted to sleep nonstop. Just, I would fall asleep in a yoga pose. I would fall asleep everywhere I went. I would just fall asleep. I would sleep 13 hours a day, but that was the first 3 days. And then on the fourth day, I started to feel great. And by the seventh day, my hip pain had disappeared. By the 10th day, my brain clicked on like I don't know if I'd ever felt it before. I remember I was in the Victorian Mountains, and I was driving along, and I felt this incredible feeling of one with the universe. And I know this sounds like I'm on drugs, but I wasn't, I swear. I was just doing food. And I just felt this amazing connection and happiness and love, and I can't explain it any other way. And I rang my girlfriend at the time, and I said to her, this is how I'm feeling. And she goes, yeah, you're definitely on drugs, Cindy. You know, and we still laugh about it today. And she was also the one that was beside me when I fell asleep in the yoga pose, so she could watch the transformation that was happening. In that first week, I lost 4.5 kilos, and that would have been water weight. It can't be fat weight, because if you lose that much fat, you would never survive as a human in a famine. So I knew that I'd lost inflammation. Well, all the pain in my body had gone. My brain clicked on. And by the end of 3 weeks, because it's a 3-week thing that you do, I had lost 9 kilos, and I felt incredible. But you can't just live on a little bit of calorie and a bit of meat and a bit of veg. So I thought, oh, I'll start introducing food back into the diet. And when I introduced bread back into the diet, within 24 hours, I'd gained 1 kilo of weight. So that's water weight. That cannot be fat weight. My hip pain was back. My brain fogged up. Everything went absolutely crazy. And I just went, what's wrong with the bread? It's the bread I make. I make it with an organic flour. I did it with a yeast. I didn't do a sourdough. And I'm like going, what is wrong? And it was at this stage, so this is like 2012, it's at this stage that I just go into a deep dive. Like if I go back in anthropological times, I know we've been eating wheat for at least 15 to 17,000 years minimum. I know the Australian Aboriginal people have eaten a grain and a seed for like tens of thousands of years. So for me, grain shouldn't have been a problem. I should have been able to eat it, and I should have been able to eat it without it causing a health problem to me, a health issue to me. So I went into a deep dive for about 2 years, and I listened to everybody I could on wheat, on agriculture, on everything. And key people were people like Stephanie Seneff, Natasha Campbell McBride, William Davies, Dr. Perlmutter. He wrote the book Brain Grain. Who else? Oh, Dr. Terry Walls. So I listened to all these people that had a really good idea of what was happening. And at the end of that 2 year period, my husband said to me, and by the way, I never ate wheat again. I just decided that I would rather feel amazing than feel bad. And so I just chose that that was out of my diet and I would not consume it again. And I've stuck with that. I actually don't eat wheat and I don't eat gluten-free anything. I just stuck with that because I love feeling amazing. I would rather give up something and feel amazing than continue eating it. Unlike some people who I say something to about their diet and I just go, well, it could be this. Do you want to maybe give that? Oh, I couldn't do that. I said, well, then live with the problem then, you know. That's another story. But so I remember saying to my husband, okay, I've figured it all out after 2 years of investigating, and he said, are you going to write a book on it? And I just said, I don't know if I want to write another book. He said, why don't you do a documentary? And I went, that could be fun. So I found all these people around the world, and on Christmas Eve I wrote them an email and just said, this is my story. I wanted to create a documentary. Would they be interested in being in my documentary? And you know, within 24 hours on Christmas Eve, four amazing women, Natasha Campbell McBride, Dr. Terry Walls, Stephanie Seneff, and Sarah Ballantyne all said yes to me. So then I was able to go back to the men and say, hey, these four have said yes. Would you like to be on my documentary? And I traveled the world. Filming everyone. Oh, Vandina Shiva was another woman that said yes to me pretty quickly as well. So I traveled the world and interviewed these incredible people. But it was Dr. Stephanie Seneff that turned the whole documentary really on its head. I remember she was my last person that I interviewed. And I'm listening to her and she's going, shikimate, glyphosate, fructose malabsorption. She's just like throwing these terms. Every question I gave her, she just kept saying, it's glyphosate, it's glyphosate, it's glyphosate. And I had to watch her interview. It was a three-hour interview. I had to watch it over and over and over again. Remember, this is early on. This is like before anybody was talking about Roundup and glyphosate and the cancers and all things like that. So I listened to it over and over again with my assistant. And we finally went, oh, my gosh, this is what's happening. And so we put the documentary together and agriculture was a big part of that documentary and how glyphosate was affecting the microbiome and replacing glycine and all sorts of things that she talked about. But we also talked about all the other aspects of what had happened to wheat. And I created the documentary What's With Wheat. It went on Netflix, did really well around the world, and that was, I think, the beginning of it. I didn't have health issues, so I didn't really think about other aspects of what was happening around me. It was just, you know, I was doing everything the best that I could with the food that I had, but when I really looked into it, that was the beginning. And then as people got sicker and sicker, we started to realize, like, this was the beginning also of phones and more and more of this. Remember, I'm an alien. I just want you to know this with electronic stuff. I'm an alien. You're a native. And so me being an alien, I wasn't brought up with devices. I was brought up in the outdoors. My dad was an adventurer. We hiked mountains. We went camping. We were always in the outdoors. So to me, that was the lifestyle that I created for my children and I've always had. So I didn't put two and two together until other people started to talk about it, like Dr. Jack Cruz. I met him very early on and, you know, really I interviewed him and just went, he's talking about all this circadian stuff. Like he throws nutrition to one side and talks about the circadian. So it was that whole thing was about me understanding about agriculture, even though my grandfather was a corn farmer in Iowa, USA. It was about really understanding what we were not doing anthropologically that we would have done. And so, of course, we had sunshine. We had night and day. We had firelight. We didn't have white lights above our, you know, above our heads. We went out and moved. We had sleep. We would sleep when the sun went down and we would wake up when the sun came up. So all of a sudden my anthropological training came back into play. So it wasn't just about nutrition now. It was about all the things that I had to fake in this modern life in order to give my body the ingredients it needed in order to be the best that it could be. And, you know, we have to. Like, I was just lucky. I was brought up in that lifestyle. I didn't know anything different. I'm someone who puts a backpack on my back and goes out hiking for 6 days. No internet, no nothing, just friends and chatter, going to bed when it gets dark, getting up, you know, when it lights up, walking all day. I'm like a modern-day hunter-gatherer with everything on the back of my back, food, you know, my shelter, everything is on there. And I think we've lost that. We stay indoors. We think 5-star is better than 1,000,000 stars. We might stay comfortable in the morning. I've heard many people say this, comfort or aging is the pursuit of comfort. And I've made the decision that I will not be comfortable. I will do everything in my power to not be comfortable. So I get up at 4:30 in the morning. I watch that sunrise. I go for a swim in the ocean. I don't care if it's hot or cold. I do freak out with some of the waves, so there is a little corner that I go to sometimes when I can't get in the big waves. But I will just realize that if I pursue comfort, I'm going to age. And you know, when you get into your 60s, you start to really question how can I keep my joints? How can I keep my flexibility? How can I not be operated on? How can I keep my brain from, you know, my brain working and all those things. So I know that was a bit of a ramble, but
it's a very important ramble. Yeah, it's very important because I think I've sort of come to a similar conclusion that, you know, we need to focus on the biggest changes in the environment first. They have to be prioritized because just from a, you know, if you're thinking about Occam's razor, you know, you want to find the simplest solution that explains the most things. That's the thing that's most likely to be right. And if we realize that the environmental changes, like you said, clearly something in the environment changed. You can no longer get the progress that you used to get with just food. So should we not be focusing on the biggest changes in the environment first? And, you know, to me, that is the electromagnetic environment, light included. And that takes into account not only the circadian effects, but the direct effects of light. And they sort of govern a lot of what else is going on. They're sort of the drain hole that everything else has to come through in order to make sense. And like you, my grandparents were farmers. They were grain farmers in rural New South Wales. Mm-hmm. So I spent the best part of my childhood, every school holidays, we were off to the farm. And they weren't organic farmers or anything, but we spent every waking moment of the day outside. We were riding motorbikes. We were getting dirty. I remember after every day, we'd be riding motorbikes all around and playing games with my cousins. And we'd get back and we'd blow our nose and our snot would be just completely dust because we were outside, you know, sucking in all the dusty roads all day. And we woke up, like you said, we woke up at the crack of dawn. I went and got the eggs from the chicken pen and my nan would cook them up
and I'd, you know, dip the toast in the yolk and then go off and play until the sun went down. And I think I can attribute the best part of my health to that experience of just being basically a wild human in an environment that was actually really, really beneficial for me. We used to tan like crazy as well in rural New South Wales. We used to be really white, then go onto the farm, and you know, 2 weeks later we'd be, you know, we'd be very brown. So, I think similar to you, I sort of had that experience of being a bit of a wild person, even though it wasn't all the time. And I think we both have, you know, the framework of our health to thank, you know, those experiences for. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the ancestral diet. I mean, there's a lot of talk about things like paleo. And like you said, the environment has shifted so much. How valid is using the ancestral diet as a heuristic, as a way to guide our decisions? How relevant is that nowadays? You know, I think there are certain nutrients that we definitely need more of than our ancestors did. Magnesium is one that comes to mind. I also think that fiber is another one that is probably more important now than it used to be, because we are exposed to so many more things, so many more chemicals that have to be expelled through that route. And fiber just helps to mop up a lot of what's going on there. So how useful is the ancestral diet, you know, even from an anthropological point of view, how relevant is that today?
Yeah, and when we say ancestral diet, there were many ancestral diets. It just depended where they lived on the planet. So if they lived in the Arctic Circle, let's say, they would have been eating flesh and fat, basically protein and fat. On an icy environment, there's not much plant food. In Norway, let's say, where the Sami are and where they still, you know, herd reindeer and eat reindeer, when the summer comes, they've got berries. They've got lots of berries. So they would have been going for plants. They wouldn't have just stuck with just their reindeer meat. They would have been eating plants. So that's because they're far from the equator. And there isn't plants around. But if we come to the equator but let's go 14,000 feet above sea level at the equator, we've still got snow and ice. And these are the people called the Kagirs of Premier. And the Kagirs of Premier are a herder. They herd yak. They eat in the winter. They not only herd the yak, they eat the old yak and they drink their dairy, basically. That's their diet. In the summer, they can consume, they have, I think, rhubarb and spring onion is basically what's available to them. They live in a very harsh climate, but this is their diet. So this is milk and meat as opposed to meat and fat over up in the Arctic Circle with some fruit. Then if we take the Hadzas, which is the community in Tanzania that we talked about, they eat anything from a bird to a primate. Their diet is 30% honey, so lots of yummy sweetness. They eat a very hard tuber where they have a microbe-like, it's a toxic microbe, but they have this microbe that helps them eat that tuber. And then, you know, and they're outside and they haven't got any clothes on and they run around in bare feet, they're grounded and et cetera. Then let's go further away from the equator and let's go to the Himbas of Namibia. And I had the opportunity to drive 3 days through a dried riverbed to the ones that do not live anywhere near the bitumen. And they're herders, they're goat herders, as well as they hunt wild game and they drink milk. And if it's a good season, they might have some plant-based foods. Now let's go to Papua New Guinea. We've got the Katavas and the Dani and the Lani. So the Katavas live on an island. They eat fish, coconuts and lots of yams and bananas and sweet, sweet, sweet fruits. Whereas the Dani and the Lani, 90% of their diet is plant-based. They don't have wild animals. They have rodents. So maybe 10% might be a rodent or an insect or something like that. So here we have, I've just given you the extremes of diet that is available to the human population that we have adapted to. And we've adapted because of the environment we live in. So to be plant-based is to be on the tropics. So if you're trying to be a vegan in Melbourne, you're doing a disservice to your body. But if you want to be plant-based, let's say, go and live in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, where it's hot, tropical, the sun's out all the time, and, you know, your body knows where it is in latitude and longitude because that's the food that's available to you and that's what you can, you know, you can use. If you want to be a meat eater, then it's those extremes. So I live on the Sunshine Coast. I have a farm. I've got 60 acres. I grow every fruit tree you can possibly think of. I grow all my plants. I have cattle. I have chickens. So I eat what's in my environment. I don't go to Coles. I don't go to Woolworths. And I know I'm an extreme case. I understand that. But at all times, if the bananas are out, I'm eating bananas. There's my fiber. If the apples are out, I'm eating apples. The citrus is coming at the moment. I've got so much citrus. So I usually get that citrus and I ferment it. So I feel like looking anthropologically at diet, that we can, depending on where we are in latitude and longitude, that we can adapt to any variety of macros. So whether you're plant-based, whether you're meat-based, all depends on where you are in latitude and longitude. And you can, and the human body adapts incredibly well by changing its microbiome, by changing its light exposure, by all of those factors, they're there. So in order for people to eat ancestrally, they have to know where they are in latitude and longitude. They have to know what food is being grown in their area and what is seasonal and what is not seasonal. And I understand, you know, for many, many centuries, we have migrated and bought foods with us. So we've been able to take nuts that will last. We're able to take grain that will last. So on occasion, I don't see a problem with this. If you look at the cadavers, in the Premier, which are 14,000 feet above sea level, they do travel 5 days and get grain to supplement their diet. But they travel 5 days to get it, and it's not available in the winter. If they run out, they run out. You know, they can't travel with their yaks to get their grain because they don't have public transport. They don't have supermarket chains or anything like that. So in a short thing, we can adapt to anything, but we need to know where we are. And we need to know what foods are available. And the way to do that is to get to your farmers' markets and talk to your farmers. Make sure you're not getting food from the local person who goes down to the city markets and just buys what's available at the city markets. Make sure you are talking to the person who is growing that food or breeding that food. So here on the Sunny Coast, I'm very so fortunate because we have lots of small farmers that do this. So we like have Tin Shed Farm. He does chicken and cattle. He doesn't do any plants. He just does animals. And I know that I can get that from him. And he does eggs as well. Then we have Good Harvest. So he's a plant grower. He doesn't have animals. He grows plants and he brings it to the local market. We've got Fig Tree Farms. We have a lamb grower. And we've got a deer hunter. And we've got, this is my local farmer's market. And I just think that when you stop going to your grocery store, they actually don't realize it. They don't know that you're one person and you've left the grocery store. But when you go to your farmer at the farmer's market, you support a small farm that, in my way of thinking, will give you health. They talk about pharmacy. That's with an pharmacy. That's what we need. We need pharmacy. Not necessarily the ultra-processed foods that we find in grocery stores that may have travelled millions of miles around the world 100 times by all the additives that come into one place and then those get flown out. And I just I find that system a non-resilient system, whereas I find our local farmers very resilient. So if you want to eat ancestrally, go to your local farmers market. If you don't have a local farmers market, perhaps growing your own food. Something that I do is I've learned with my farm that a lot of people want to know what I do. They want to see what I do. And so every year I do a thing called the Festival of Food and Farming. And it's for 50 people only. It's to come and immerse yourself on the farm for 4 days and learn the techniques that we do on the farm, which are regeneratively do farming in the way of natural sequence farming, biodynamics, cell grazing, chicken husbandry, what else are we doing? Poly crops, not crops so much, but poly grasses, so that our animals can pick what they need. So we teach that every year, just once a year in August, so that people can learn to grow their own food. So it's for the farmer, it's for the person who wants to just grow in their backyard. One of the things that we do, which is just my favourite thing to walk through every time I'm up my farm, is Syntropics. So it's agroforestry, where we have eucalypts growing with apple trees, growing with banana trees, growing with citrus trees. And then underneath I have all my herbs and any vegetables that choose to grow, my garlic, my ginger. It's like this self-perpetuating system that we never ever bring inputs in. It grows, we chop and drop, we put the inputs in ourselves by our own growing of the agroforestry. So yeah, people love to find out about this. And I realized this when I started my research on wheat. So at the end of my documentary, I say that the story of wheat is the story of food. And it's time to become educated about what they're doing to our food system and what we need to do in order to survive it. And whether you choose to grow some of your foods or all of your foods, a lot of people are doing what I'm doing, is we just have small farm lots and we just try and grow as much as we possibly can. But if you can't, then you've got your farmers markets. You've got, I look at Good Harvest, Mick at Good Harvest. I remember when he started, he's a marine biologist who couldn't stand what was happening to the oceans because of agriculture. So he thought, well, why don't I do something about it? Why don't I grow my own food? And so he started to grow his own food, and then he started to grow for a community, and now he grows for an even larger community now. And he started by leasing land. He didn't have his own land. He leased his own land. And this is what I love. I love these stories.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And we're quite blessed here in Australia. I think we have the most acreage. We have the most regenerative land of any country in the world. And biodynamics is quite a big thing here. But I guess I'll just try and sum up what we were talking about with the ancestral diet, which is the ancestral diet, in quotes, is kind of a misnomer. What it really is what's available to you where you are. And, you know, we have to remember that nature decides. All of these cultures that you spoke about ate the foods that they ate because that was what's available. That is what nature allows in a sense, you know, and they're following the rules and probably reaping the benefits. And if we just follow the rules about what is available to us where we are, I think that is essentially what the ancestral diet really is. And it will continue to be that way forever. I wanted to ask you about biodynamics because it's I've been a big follower of Steiner's biodynamics for many years now, and it's for people who don't know, it's kind of, my friend described it as wizardry meets agriculture, which I thought was a very apt way to put it, because you're basically getting all of these weird things, stirring them in a bucket for like 45 minutes, and then, you know, spraying them out with you know, some leaves or something over your crop in sort of like a homeopathic way. And for some reason it works. I don't think anyone can really describe why. Steiner died before he was able to say how he came up with all of these preparations that he did. But I used to work on a biodynamic farm, and we used to throw out the preps. We used to throw out the 500, which is the main preparation. And it's a bit, it's pretty magical to be a part of when you're stirring that that bucket with the 500 preparation in it, and just feeling the water sort of change the more that you stir it. And is that something that you do, you know, on a fairly regular basis, is throw out a prep on your farm and watch it work over the coming weeks?
Yeah, we use biodynamics in more than just preps, but in when we plant, when we chop and drop, when we rest, when our cattle decide that they're going to sit down. You should watch it. It's incredible. The cattle have this cycle where they know when they've got to sit and, you know, do the rumination of their food. So it's not just about the preps. It's about everything that we do on that land. And, yes, we've got a cattle. What is it called? A cow paddy. We've got a cow paddy. We have all the preps and we're pretty, it's really important to do them at the right times. And yes, it is like voodoo magic or something like that. But if you understand that vibration, energy, thought, that these all make a difference in what is happening on your land. I want to give you a really good example of this. And this is, to me, is biodynamics at its greatest. So I have a friend, this only happened yesterday, by the way. So I have a friend who has become quite sick. He has 44 cattle on this vast piece of land that is almost a mud pit. And at 1 o'clock in the morning of the day that I'm to go and get these cattle with my husband and my son, so only three of us to get 44 cattle in a mud pit with extremes in the acreage, I'm having anxiety and thinking, we're never going to be able to do this. The truck arrives at 8. They've all got to be on the truck. We're never going to be able to do it. But then I changed my attitude. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, I started to go, and people are going to laugh at me. And I started to go, spirit of the gods of the cows, please let the cows know what we're doing for them. We're getting them out of the mud pit. We're going to put them on a truck. We're going to head them south to drier lands where they won't get any problems, where there'd be lots of food and they'll be well looked after. It wasn't a matter of these cattle being slaughtered. This was, we were just moving them to another pasture. I have to tell you, and I kept doing it. So I finally got to sleep, got up at 5:30. We were there by 6. We had till 8 o'clock before the truck arrived. We got those cattle in at 10 past 8. So by the time we found the cattle, we had to find them first. You have to get them across a creek system. You don't want them taking off. Anyone who's mustered cattle will understand what I'm saying. And I just kept saying, and I don't know where it came from, but I just kept saying, spirit of the gods of the cows, please let them know that they are safe. And I would just be directing them as to where I went. Yes, I had my husband and my son with me. And it not one, and we've been and done this before, and the cows nick off and go everywhere because there's no fencing, there's nothing. And do you know that those cattle stayed in a mob, walked slowly. Every now and then one would take off, but then it would come back in again. And this to me is biodynamics. It's subtle energy. It's what we can't see, but we have this incredible, innate, intelligent energy that it's like manifesting. It's like when we manifest. If we manifest bad stuff in our life because we're always thinking about it. And you see those people, they have all these bad things happening in their lives because they're always manifesting them. But if you have that attitude of gratitude and that belief that there is an innate intelligence out there and that you have that innate intelligence in you and that food has an innate intelligence and that your vibration is affecting whatever is around you, then that's biodynamics. That to me is the essence of, like, I get goosebumps even thinking about it and watching it, and yeah.
It's the return of vitalism to agriculture, you know, mm-hmm. treating the entire piece of land as if it's an organism rather than, you know, different parts of the land for different things. And it's kind of like the microbiome in a way. If you use lots of different species, it becomes much more resilient than if you just monocrop. And that we're seeing that. I think agriculture, even things like rainforests are the perfect example of what's going on in the microbiome. You know, if you remove keystone species, the whole balance gets disturbed. And what you want is a more diverse environment because it makes it more resilient and more less susceptible to perturbations. And I think, yeah, agriculture is intimately tied in to human health. Biodynamics is such a wonderful thing because, yeah, you think it's crazy. It doesn't matter what day you plant a seed on. Why would that matter? Well, there are root days, there are flower days, you know, there are leaf days, and they all matter on the to, you know, when you plant them to how the plant grows. And there's actually quite a lot of evidence out there that that's actually true, even though it sounds ridiculous and how could it possibly make a difference? But it certainly does work, and the farmers who employ it know that it works. And I think the fact that we don't know why it works precisely is actually to our to our great benefit because we're actually not stuck thinking about trying to understand mechanistically what's going on because we're never going to win that battle. So I think guys like Charlie Arnett, they say, don't worry about how it works, just do it. And I wish we did that more in medicine a little bit, more in health. You know, if we know something works, don't worry about how, just do it. It works. Mm. And that's what I really, really like about Regen Ag and particularly biodynamics. I'd love to
see just going on from
that.
Oh,
yeah, sure. Yep.
So like we talked about medicine being mechanistic, food being mechanistic, agriculture is also mechanistic.
Yeah.
And we're seeing this shift in food, medicine, and agriculture. And that's to me, the best thing that we can see that shift in. There will be times when all need to be mechanistic for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we've got to see this shift across to vitalism. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I often think the biggest step we've, or at least one of the biggest steps we've made in medicine was antibiotics because they save lives. But, you know, when you're using them in situations that aren't saving lives, they actually probably have the opposite effect. And it's being able to effectively integrate the mechanistic and the vitalistic together because that's when they're both at their maximum strength. So yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's not the abandonment of looking mechanistically because ultimately that's humans love doing that. We love to dig down and find things out, and we're never going to stop. But it's about how to integrate that into a broader context that makes everything make more sense. I heard your conversation with Jack Cruz many years ago. And you were very early on in this discussion about what's more important and this conversation surrounding the light, water, magnetism, the things that NASA used to determine whether life is possible on a planet that's far away. It makes sense now, but at the time it's a bit difficult, you know, if you haven't been introduced to the ideas of Jack. It sounds a bit wacky, but of course it all makes sense when you dig deep enough. What was it like speaking to him and how did that change the way you went about things? Because I do plan on trying to speak to him hopefully this year, but it's quite a daunting thing, isn't it?
It's very daunting. I can't remember when I got introduced to Jack, but it was a long, long time ago. And then we decided to have him on our podcast many, many years ago. And I remember, so there used to be three of us on the podcast. We were called up for a chat and there was Karen, Kim and I. And Karen couldn't make it this time, so it was just Kim and I. And at the end of the conversation, basically, he just ridiculed diet and everything else. And Kim and I got off the phone to, you know, off the Zoom call to him, and just, I think I was depressed for a week. I just thought, is everything I've ever thought wrong? And he's a smart man. Like the first time I ever heard him speak must have been when I was doing the wheat thing, the whole wheat thing, because he was doing lectin. That's right. That was when lectin was the big thing in his conversation, lectin and lectin resistance. And he talked about his blown out knee. And so that's where I started with Jack. He wasn't talking about light and stuff like that. It was all leptin. And then, you know, he graduated to all of this stuff. And now he's, you know, he's in El Salvador and very different. But I do remember him absolutely obliterating nutrition. But the good thing about it is that he gave me the name of a gentleman here in Australia that I should interview. And I rang him within 3 or 4 days of being on the podcast with Jack because I was really upset. His name was Jason Borden-Smith. And Jason, I said to Jason, Jack Cruz said that I should contact you. You might be able to help us with some more conversation around what Jack talks about. And Jason and I became really good friends. He came on the podcast the week after Jack and really calmed both Kim and I down. But I think Jack's changed a little bit on the food side. I do see him talking more on food, whereas before, you know, on light and day, you know, I mean, on latitude and longitude and maybe eating what's in your environment. But, yeah, he's I think he's an incredible mind. He's honest. He's arrogant, if I can say it that way. But I don't know what we'd do without him. That's what I think. Yeah. Is that I think he's got an incredible mind, and sometimes these incredible minds, you just have to be mindful of what's going on in their brain, and that they see you as fools because you can't understand them, yet they understand the incredible intricacies. And I think if anybody's going to be a formidable opponent, it's you.
I'm certainly not an opponent. I think without him, I'm not sure where my health would be today. And I think he's abrasive and arrogant for a very good reason, because he has to be. And I've spoken about this before, that if we don't have people that are abrasive and purposefully hyperbolic like he is, people like me don't snap out of the idiotic way of thinking that I was in several years ago. And I think we really need people. He's just a logical conclusion of where the medical world is at. People like him were always going to come around because of how absolutely wacky our medical system is. It's just a foregone conclusion that people like him are going to call it how they see it. And it is kind of crazy. And of course, diet plays a role. Diet plays a significant role. But I think for him, there are enough people talking about the significant role of diet, and he wanted to talk about and continues to talk about the things that he thinks, and I tend to agree with him, are probably at this point in where we are today in 2024 are probably more important. He's formidable, but he certainly changes the way that people think about this health space. And I think both you and I appreciate him for that.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And Jason Borden-Smith says he saved his life.
Yeah.
Although Jason has now passed, but he went from somebody who was, you know, in his 50s and not going to do well to, you know, spending a lot of time with Jack, and Jack and Jason became really good friends. And it was, when Jason passed, I was in shock because I thought he'd licked what was happening to him. But obviously there were other things that he needed to figure out. But, yeah, Jack says, Jason said the same thing as you did. If it wasn't for Jack, I wouldn't be alive today. That's what he said to me,
It's funny how people like that can be. It's funny how experiences like that can be the most important. The things that are often the most difficult are the most meaningful in the long run. You've been doing this for a long time, like what, 40, is it 44 years?
44 years. 1980 is when my journey with nutrition began, and in at the University of Colorado, and my journey with I did the study of stars, and I also did the study of words. So they were my electives, and I just look back at it and I think, if I didn't do those things, I don't know where I'd be today. You don't realize it until you're in hindsight.
What are the biggest things that you've learned? What has been the biggest piece of wisdom, or the biggest few pieces of wisdom that you've learned over that period of time? Because I'm still relatively fresh in this journey, and you have been doing this for a really long time. So that wisdom is something that I'd love to hear a bit about.
I think number one, you'll never know everything.
Yeah.
And I think that would be number one. You'll never know everything. So soak in as much as you can. And I don't ever say no to something. I listen to it and I give it a chance. And then if it fits in with my philosophy and of vitalism and my understanding and historical perspective, then I'll take it on board and I'll learn more about it. So number one is, you'll never know everything. Keep learning. Number two, have a philosophy. Otherwise, you're going to fall for everything. And I was very fortunate to be given vitalism as my philosophy at a very young age. You know, that's what my father taught, innate intelligence and vitalism. And so have a philosophy to have a guide. Because if you, like I said, if you don't have that guide, you will fall for everything. That's why some people go, oh, I'm going to be a vegan. Oh, no, I'm going to go carnivore. Oh, no, I should be breathing. No, I should be ice bathing. No, I should be like. So you, if you have that philosophy and that guide and really listen to your body would be number three. Because if you do not listen to the whispers in your body will start screaming at you. And that's when mechanism is required.
Yeah, I think it's very important to have something that grounds you and that philosophy that helps you avoid bad ideas or at least helps you vet bad ideas adequately because it protects you from going down rabbit holes that you shouldn't necessarily go down and certainly knowing that you're never going to know anything and no one is ever going to know everything. And it's to the point where we might actually not even know anything. And we have to, I think that's kind of a beautiful thing more than something to be feel down about is that, you know, nature is so infinitely complex that we'll never really get a full grasp on it. And I think that's way more of a beautiful thing than anything else. It's like a fractal. You'll never get to the end.
I think being curious is really important. And that's where your education comes in because I find you're very curious. I listen to your questions and the fact that you've started the podcast, that's because you're curious. It makes you vulnerable, but also courageous. And from your curiosity, it's incredible where you can end up. If you're not curious, then you'll just do what you're told.
Yeah.
You know, if you're told that you should be taking antibiotics and you should be taking cholesterol-lowering tablets or you should be taking this for the rest of your life, and then you don't go, but why? Is there something else that I can do? Is there another lifestyle that I can change? Can I look at this or that? Yeah. So, yeah.
Great. That's a great few pieces of wisdom that I think if everyone sort of took even one of them on board, they would sort of fortify themselves and allow them to make much better decisions over the period of their life. That's sort of a great way to wrap up. And I'd love to thank you for what you've done. I remember watching the documentary, I think when it first came out that you did, and I think that was my introduction to Stephanie Seneff as well. And I remember being fascinated by her as well. So you've probably played a bigger role in my curiosity than you even know. So thank you for all that you've done and all the people that you've helped and continue to help. I'm sure I'm going to see you in a couple of weeks, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
I'll be in Melbourne, so I look forward to it.
It's good saying goodbye knowing that I will see you soon. I don't often get to do that with my podcast guests, so this will be really exciting to recap in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, most definitely. And thank you, Cameron. I just love what you're doing. I love your youth. You've got longevity and keep doing what you're doing. Get those great guests in because I'll be listening to you.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed the conversation. I've left many links to all of Cindy's different projects in the episode notes if you'd like to learn more about what she's doing. If you'd like to support the podcast, please subscribe and leave a positive review as this really helps me reach more listeners and get more interesting guests. If you'd like to keep up with my work, I've left links to all of my social media platforms in the episode notes. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.